Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the November NJEDA Board Meeting. At this time, all four phone participants are in a listen-only mode. Please be advised today's meeting is being recorded. When the chairman opens the public comment portion of the meeting, members of the public attending by phone will be advised to press 1, then 0 on your telephone keypad to be placed into the queue to speak and provide comment. You will be asked to provide your name and any organization with which you are affiliated. You may withdraw your question at any time by repeating the 1-0 command. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up the handset before pressing the numbers. If you should require assistance during the call, please press star, then 0. I would now like to turn the conference over to Chairman Terry O'Toole. Please go ahead.
Thank you, operator. I want to call the meeting to order. Tim, do you want to read the Open Public Meeting Notice?
Mr. Chairman. In accordance with the Open Public Meeting Act, notice of this meeting has been sent to the Star Ledger and the Times of Trenton at least 48 hours prior to this meeting, and a meeting notice has been posted on the Secretary of State's bulletin board at the Department of State.
Thank you, Tim. Manera, could you call the roll?
Chairman Terrence O'Toole.
Here.
Phil Villaggio.
Here.
Paul Johnson. Here. Robert Tinto.
Here.
Fred Dumont.
Here.
Rocio Ferrara.
Here.
Marcia Marley.
Here.
Aaron Cruz from the Executive Branch.
Here.
State Treasurer Elizabeth Moyo.
Here.
Banking Commissioner Justin Zimmerman.
Here.
Commissioner Robert Angelo.
Here.
Elizabeth Dragon for DEP Commissioner Sean Lazarette.
Here.
Mr. Chairman, we have a quorum.
Thank you, Manera. First item is to approve meeting the minutes from last month's meeting. Board members, before you are the minutes from the October 12th NJEDA board meeting for review and approval. I kindly request that board members state their name for the record when making a motion or a second. Thank you. Could I hear a motion to approve the October 12th board meeting minutes, please?
So moved.
Thank you. Second?
Second.
Thank you. Any discussions? Any recusals or abstentions? None being heard, all in favor, say yes. Yes.
Yes.
Any opposed?
Yes.
Any opposed? All right, none being heard, the minutes are approved. Let me begin with the chair's remarks. Good morning and welcome everyone to the November board meeting. I think all the board members have at their chairs the board dashboard from October, and I want to thank Tim and the team for putting this together. This is the second time we have this dashboard, and it's a real, I think it's a really helpful reminder of everything that we do here at the EDA. So thank you for presenting that, and this will be presented at each of the board meetings going forward. This morning I'm going to focus my remarks on the EDA's significant role in implementing real estate development projects across New Jersey. Since 1979, the authority has developed over 10 million square feet of new and renovated space, valued at over $1.5 billion. The EDA has a 44-year history of real estate development. The authority's role has grown considerably under the Murphy administration, including an expanded, yet more targeted, suite of solutions designed to drive investment in high-quality, affordable housing options, transform dormant commercial and residential properties into community assets, advance promising commercial projects, and support intentional placemaking. Our goal isn't to compete with private developers. It's to find opportunities to collaborate with the private sector and the trailblaze locations and sectors in need of private investment. Perhaps the most noteworthy current EDA project is the development of the New Jersey Wind Port, located on the eastern shore of the Delaware River in Lower Alloways Creek, Salem County. The port will be the first purpose-built wind port on the East Coast, with no vertical restrictions and easy access to more than 50% of the available U.S. offshore wind lease areas. Now, we all know we had a recently very disappointing and frustrating news from Ørsted regarding their Ocean Wind 1 and 2 projects, which, as the governor stated, is clearly a setback. I know Tim will talk about some of the steps we're taking or preparing to take in response to that, but I want to echo what I know the governor, Tim, and the entire administration believe, that despite the setback, there continue to be massive opportunities for New Jersey in this new sector, and in making investments in infrastructure and the manufacturing capacity to support it. One tool that will play a pivotal role in the advancement of major real estate projects moving forward is the Aspire program, which was created by the Economic Recovery Act of 2020. Aspire is a place-based economic development program designed to support mixed-use, transit-oriented development with tax credits for commercial and residential use real estate projects that have financing gaps. All residential Aspire projects or any mixed-use project with a residential component must include at least 20% affordable housing. The first project to be approved under Aspire, the Helix Health and Life Science Exchange in New Brunswick, will transform the neighborhood near the city's transit station into a bustling innovation district. To date, under the residential components of the program, this board has approved a total of $314 million in Aspire awards for residential projects, creating over 1,660 housing units, nearly 73% of which will be affordable. Today, you will be asked to consider a new program that will help advance impactful real estate projects while promoting equity and fairness in the development community. The $20 million Emerging Developer Grant Program will award grants of up to $250,000 to assist small-scale developers with up to 50% of their pre-development soft costs. The NJEDA is also equipped to support the research, manufacturing, and office needs of entrepreneurial startups, emerging research companies, and large established corporations in the bioscience and pharmaceutical industries at the New Jersey Bioscience Center, located in the heart of New Jersey's research corridor. The 50-acre Bioscience Center is home to the incubator and step-out labs of North Brunswick and consists of almost 300,000 square feet of lab and office space with over $70 million invested in facilities and improvements, including a shared conference facility. Later today, Governor Murphy will announce that the NJEDA will invest $20 million in EdgeWorks, an approximately 120,000 square foot life sciences innovation hub to be built adjacent to the Liberty Science Center in Jersey City. Anticipated costs for the total EdgeWorks project are more than $116 million. Liberty Science Center is engaged in a large expansion to build what will become the 30-acre SciTech City innovation campus located in Jersey City. EdgeWorks, an eight-story business creation hub of the Science Center, will house laboratories, research and development spaces, office suites, co-working spaces for dozens of startups, a tech exhibition gallery, and a state-of-the-art conference center. In addition to EdgeWorks, SPS will also include the Liberty Science Center High School, a new public STEM high school for Hudson County, and Scholars Village, consisting of 500 units of residential housing for tech-forward families and individuals. There are many other resources in the NJEDA's real estate development toolkit, including historic property reinvestment tax credits, financing solutions for brownfields, asset activation grants, the Activation Revitalization and Transformation, or ARC program, and even a program to help municipalities with infrastructure upgrades to better support film production projects. The NJEDA's contributions to the state's real estate development community are yet another indicator of our significant impact on the state and its residents. And with that, I'll turn it over to Tim for his CEO's report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's been quite a month since we were back together up in Newark. Lots of great stuff and a couple things that are a little bit less great. But broadly speaking, it's been a bit of a whirlwind of a month. We had our board meeting on Thursday. The next morning on Friday, myself and Andrew Cross joined a 60-plus person delegation led by the governor and the first lady and to New Jersey to East Asia. We had a great trip. It was really productive. We brought back a ton of good follow-ups and more business cards probably than any trip I've ever been on. I highly recommend if you're going to do three world cities. And not be a zombie at the end. You probably budget more than 9 days to hit Tokyo, Seoul, and Taipei. But we had great meetings in all three places, and the governor saw the head of state in all three places, the first lady. I got to join those meetings too, which was pretty cool. And so, really good trip to sort of reintroduce New Jersey to East Asia. While we were there, we also signed the EDA, entered into an agreement with the Economic Ministry of Taiwan to foster further collaboration there, and I also joined the First Lady in signing an agreement, a collaboration agreement essentially between the Maternal Infant Health Center that we're developing here in Trenton and one in a suburb of Seoul, which is a pretty cool visit as well. So we have lots of good follow-up, lots of good activity there. And the governor and the First Lady led an extraordinary trip to choose New Jersey, so it was really great. Keeping going chronologically, so we get back, that's all good. Everyone's sort of fired up from Asia, and then it's Halloween, and we get some different news out of the offshore wind industry. I think you saw in the governor's statement both of the sort of sentiments that I think are appropriate. One, pretty significant frustration and disappointment. You know, the governor chooses his words pretty carefully, particularly when he writes them down, That was a pretty hot statement of frustration, as is appropriate, and disappointment. But at the same time, I think you heard, as the chairman just mentioned, you know, continued optimism. The U.S. there is so much private capital being invested in the U.S. wind industry. There is so much private sector interest, and as evidenced by New York just having a really successful third solicitation of their wind program, the BPU. Led by its new president, Christine Zadovi, is in the middle of reviewing applications for New Jersey's third solicitation, which has had a really strong crop of applications. You know, other states are pushing forward. We'll continue to push forward. This is a setback, but you know, one company is not the offshore wind industry here in New Jersey. We're going to go into executive session and talk a bit about some of the steps we're going to take at the port and some of our training programs as well. But you know, broadly, it would be foolish to just do nothing and say, let's just keep pushing ahead full speed. It's appropriate to sort of step back and calibrate and make sure we're, you know, being thoughtful and smart about how we're, pursuing the port, pursuing our wind strategy. But the North Star remains the North Star here, which is that there's going to be a big, big North Atlantic U.S. offshore wind industry. New Jersey is in the catbird seat to lead it. This is clearly a setback. It would be strain the bounds of credulity to say it wasn't a setback, but with what Orsted announced, but you know, we will get through it. There will probably be some continued challenges. The offshore wind industry is going through a big set of challenges due to things like interest rates being essentially three times what they were when this journey started, and the price of steel being up 65-70%, and steel-intensive projects. The good news is that the projects that were canceled or announced to be no longer being developed are part of a kind of a crop of projects that were kind of the early wave. And a lot of those early wave projects were before the pandemic, before supply chain challenges, before inflation. There is a new vintage of projects coming along in Massachusetts, New York, soon to be New Jersey, soon to be Maryland as well, that are much more resilient and kind of built for those challenges. So certainly some short-term challenges, some short-term headaches, probably not done with some short-term headaches, but the cause for optimism, I think, is quite factual and data-driven. Again, at the same time, of a month of challenges and also some good news. Robert was there with the governor and the First Lady and a number of other elected leaders and labor leaders at Fort Monmouth a week or so ago to celebrate the sort of continuation of Netflix's major investment in Fort Monmouth. Kara and the team have done an extraordinary job at the fort driving that project forward. A lot of wood to chop between here and opening day for that major project, but that's a billion-dollar private sector investment in a piece of property that has been an albatross around Monmouth County since it closed almost 15 years, and since it was announced to be closed almost 15 years ago. So really good progress there. Last thing I'll mention is I was many of us were, and some people still are, in fact, in Atlantic City at the League of Municipalities meeting. I was down there yesterday for a day trip. Made it back in time to go to the Rutgers game last night with the Labor Commissioner. I don't remember who won. Rutgers and Georgetown made it. Rutgers and Georgetown made it. Rob, we may need to follow up on that. We need some apprenticeship programs for Jesuit college basketball players. We just don't have to.
Apprenticeship for everybody.
There's a skills gap. I know you're really focused on that. I love the work you do there. We may need to step up.
Are you saying college players are employees, Tim?
Oh, man. Don't start, Commissioner. Love you, bud. But anyway, so I was in Atlantic City yesterday. We happened to announce something we approved at the October board meeting, which is a major investment in food security in Atlantic City. So Atlantic City has been plagued by food insecurity. It is the number two ranked food desert community in the rankings that Tara and her team have established. Number two is bad. You would like to be number 565, not number two. And so We announced a package of programs that will provide immediate relief and immediate action for food access, for fresh, healthy, affordable food. Virtua is going to be running essentially a mobile grocery bus 2 days a week, which they do in Camden and Burlington counties now. They're going to expand that to Atlantic City, at least for a couple months. And then AtlantiCare has been a great partner in this. It's also going to be expanding its mobile food distribution. This is selling food, not giving away food. And then we'll stand up a new grant. We are standing up a new grant program to allow lots of organizations to make proposals to us for other ways to attack food insecurity in not just in Atlantic City, which is also a bit of a precursor to a broader stepping up of those efforts around the major food desert concentrated communities. So really good announcement there. And the governor had said, particularly after there was an attempt to develop a full-scale grocery store that failed in September or so, the governor said, we have to do something now and big. And there's work to be done, but in terms of getting from here between there now and then and now, a tremendous amount of work, tremendous amount of effort. Special shout out to Tara, to Christina, who knows more about Atlantic City than probably anyone in the world. So driving hopefully some real change there as well. Chairman mentioned, and I'll shut up, the Ford dashboard. again, I think just a really good indication of the amount of activity that happens in between these meetings. We come for big approvals here, and we've got a bunch of big approvals, particularly on the program side today. So we don't have the longest agenda we've ever had, but we have a pretty dense agenda today. But almost 200 approvals for various things just in the month of October. Nearly 100 of those are Main Street small business type programs. The Angel Tax Credit is a heavy hitter here. Child care continues to make approvals and major investments in our child care sector. The bottom of the ninth of a cold, and giving me a cough in a board meeting, which is great. Not COVID. I've said it 100,000 times.
Thanks for telling me now.
tremendous amount of activity here, and you can see that the operational results as well as the financial results of the authority, we're in really good shape, given everything we've been asked to do and take on. And so the amount of work that sort of gets encapsulated here, I think, is extraordinary. I just want to express deep appreciation to my colleagues and my teammates who work here every day, as well as this board for supporting all the work and all the investment that goes into this, led by the governor, of course, but driven and shepherded by this board so well. So thank you for that. With that, happy to take any questions. This is one of the meat of the agenda, which is pretty meaty. There's a lot to do today.
Okay. Thank you, Kim. As we are now doing it at the board meetings, we're going to give readouts of the sort of highlights of the committee meetings that take place between the board meetings. So I'm going to start with the policy committee report. The policy committee and real estate committee also met on November 2nd. The policy committee had a robust agenda. The committee began with a funding increase request to support an integral internal software system interface, which we'll talk about later today, I think. This was followed by a presentation from the community development team on a new proposed program, the Emerging Developers Program, which was also presented to the Real Estate Committee and which will support emerging developers for soft costs during pre-development of a project, which we'll talk about later. Next was a memo pertaining to the Asset Activation Planning Grant Program concerning a declination and program management. Moving through the agenda under the next section, Economic Transformation, staff presented another new proposed program, the NJ Cool Pilot Program, which will provide grants to support retrofits in existing commercial buildings that will result in reduced greenhouse gas emissions in specific municipalities, which we will hear about later today. Next was a presentation on an amendment to the NJ ZIP Pilot Program, followed by a memo to request support for the creation of a second phase of the commuter and transit bus private carrier relief and jobs program, which we will discuss later. And under venture, staff presented recommendations for the qualified venture firm approvals under the NJ Innovation Evergreen Fund, as well as for an inaugural cohort of the NJ Innovation Fellows Program, which we will discuss later today. So the first matter we will consider for a vote is Emerging Developers Program, and Janelle Johnson will present.
Good morning. So I am here today to present the Emerging Developer Grant Fund Program. This pilot program is created with a budget of $20 million from the Fiscal Year 23 Appropriations Act. These funds will be deposited into our Earth account to proceed with the funding of this program. As for the eligibility, this program is created for profit and nonprofit developers that have completed at least 2 but no more than 5 projects. We are going to take a stance of moving forward with mixed use and commercial. Residential projects are prohibited. We feel that there's enough with HMSA, DCA, and GRA taking on that route of proceeding with those. So this program is created with Governor Murphy's intent to build and bolster a stronger and fairer economy. We are providing grants up to $200,000. There will be a bonus for $250,000 for projects that are located in our designated opportunity zone. There's approximately 169 of them, and we're also going to give that bonus for our government-restricted municipalities, which includes Atlantic City, Patterson, and Trenton. Part of this program, the requirement is that the developer must have site control, so that the way this program works is we will fund soft costs only, not related to anything related to construction, and we will provide 50% of those eligible costs. The developer will provide an invoice and or receipt, and we will confirm that the invoice coincides with the address that's on the application. The development entity must own at least 51% of the project. Once a project is approved, the program will be created on a rolling basis based on the readiness to proceed. Once we've identified approvals, there will be 30 days for any cures or approvals, and at that time, a grant agreement will be signed. The grant agreement will be enforced for 12 months, so at that time, we will allow the developer, as they're submitting invoices and receipts, to submit the information to draw down on the cost of the program. It's pretty clean cut. I believe I don't have too much more for you. As also our chairman said, you know, this program is definitely, it's essential, it's needed, it'll level the playing field for our real estate development and economy. A lot of these developers, their projects just aren't big enough to access our tax credits, and we recognize that. So we feel that this program will work to improve blighted and stalled projects, particularly with a focus on mixed-use development in underserved and distressed communities, in addition to our other neighboring cities throughout the state. Happy to answer any questions, comments you may have.
The program is going to cover the soft costs for the project itself. Once it gets past that, is the companies that are looking to receive the funding here, are they educated on other programs that they might be eligible for once it becomes a construction project?
They are, and we are continuing. This program, we intend on it launching in February, and in the meantime, we are having roundtables. We're doing outreach. We are coordinating with NJRA. We just had a call with DCA last week. We're working with the different chambers. And so as a result of that, we're looking to bring a lot of the smaller developers into the room. And then we're also having Developers Day within our government-restricted municipalities, and it's specifically for smaller developers. And our senior development officer, Diana Rogers, she's actually heading that, so we already have, like, our dates in place. So we're doing as much outreach as we can, and we are encouraging the developers to let them know that they're not limited to this one grant, and we are looking for them to stack as many resources as they can.
Just to follow up, so this grant is the only one that they can apply. They can only apply to this grant.
No. They can apply to what this
soft cost.
Right, for soft cost. This is not federal funds, so we don't trigger any duplication of benefits, but we're encouraging these developers to apply for what is out there that works and aligns with the project from the state. That's to our resources.
For many, if not new, by statute, most of the things like Aspire have a minimum unit count or a minimum square footage count. Less true for NJRA and less true for DCA's programs and NJRA's programs, so they certainly could apply for those. Excuse me.
Well, first of all, please invite the Department of Labor to your outreach events. We help them workforce issues. But two, can you talk about what, why above 2, under 5, and then also what does completed project mean?
Okay, so above 2 and under 5, that number is very intentional because we want to make sure that the developer has the capacity to proceed with the request of their application. We want to make sure that there is some experience in their portfolio, which is a requirement of the program, and we're doing it to make sure we stick with the name as to the emerging developer, right? So it's very intentional to ensure that the smaller arising developers do get an opportunity to access state assistance.
Any other questions? Anyone on the phone, questions or comments?
Okay, hearing none, can I have a motion to approve?
Second motion.
Thank you. A second?
Angelo, second.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying yes, yes?
Yes.
Yes.
Any opposed? Any refusals or abstentions? Hearing none, the motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, Matt Boyle on the New Jersey Asset Activation Planning Grant.
Good morning. The Asset Activation Planning Grant Program has two recommendations for the board today, a grant decision for one application and an additional delegated authority. The Asset Activation Program provides grants of up to $50,000 for pre-development planning activities of vacant or underutilized public assets. The program was approved in March 2022, and the first round of applications were received that summer. Applications aren't competitively scored against each other, but they must meet a minimum score of 65 points out of 100 to demonstrate the ability to successfully complete the proposed planning activities. And to gauge the improved utilization of the public asset. Applications for the program are viewed and scored and recommended for awards in a rolling process based on the order in which they were submitted. The program received 11 applications in 2022, 9 accepted awards and executed their grant agreements. Those 9 planning projects are either completed or will be concluded in the coming months. On April 12, 2023, the board approved a new round of grants. The 90-day application window just closed this Monday, November 13th, this Monday. 17 applications have been submitted in total, and 2 have completed the review process. The first of those has been declined for failing to meet non-discretionary requirements of the program. The second application is now recommended for declination, having failed to meet the minimum score requirement. To briefly summarize that proposal, the borough of Pennington requested grant funding of $41,500 to undertake a redevelopment planning process for the Pennington landfill properties. Three lots making up the site have been previously used for public water supply, solid waste landfill, and a fuel depot. It has known contamination issues, and a portion of the site currently used for public works operations and parking. Their proposed project would begin with redevelopment needs investigation, followed by a market and feasibility study and a community forum and concept design that concludes with a final redevelopment plan. The scoring committee determined the application from the borough of Pennington received 60.2 out of 100 points, which does not meet the score threshold of 65. The board is therefore requested to decline the grant award. Additionally, as part of the program's initial policy and specs, the board delegated authority to EDA staff to decline applications that do not meet eligibility requirements solely due to non-discretionary reasons and to issue final administrative decisions for appeals of declinations based solely on non-discretionary reasons. Those delegated authorities continue for the second round of the program. Given the maximum award amount for this program is relatively low, and considering the scheduling constraints of the rolling applications process for the program, we believe it would be advantageous to the program's goals and respectful of the board's schedule to include additional delegated authority to issue final administration decisions on grant awards. Any questions at this time?
Any questions?
Just note out of austerity and an abundance of caution, I'm recused from the Pennington matter because I was there. What's on Parks and Rec? Commission board group, that's all they do. It's important.
Okay.
So I have no idea how we arrived at the score. I'm sure it's right.
Anyone on the phone, any questions, comments?
All right, none being heard, could I hear a motion to approve?
Robert Shimko.
Thank you. Second?
Jewel.
Thank you. Any further discussions? Tim has recused. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, none being heard, the motion passes. Thank you. All right, next I'm going to give a brief report on the Incentives Committee meeting in the absence of Ginny Bauer, who is the Incentive Committee Chair. The Incentives Committee met on November 1st. Staff presented proposed new rules for the Aspire program, as well as an Aspire project recommended for approval, which we will, we're going to discuss the Aspire rules shortly. The committee also considered two GROW NJ modifications. One pertained to Morgan Stanley. Both Ginny Bauer and I are going to recuse from that discussion, given a fiduciary relationship we have with Morgan Stanley. So with that, I think George is going to be up first.
Hi, Kevin. Kevin Smith, excuse me, our Aspire director here to help answer questions. If there are specific questions about backup singers.
Wow. I did bring
up an 82-page rules document. I did bring up backup singers. Good morning, board members. We're here to request approval for special adoption and final adoption if no substantive comments are received for the updated Aspire rules reflecting changes in new legislation as well as experience that the Aspire team has gained an improvement project throughout this year.
So I would just want to, we have, I think, several slides.
Sure, several slides.
Yeah. A little complicated, so it'll help us kind of go through it.
Yeah. Before I start, I just want to say, you know, the rules writing process is very complex and involved. It's kind of a whole of authority effort. I do want to give special thanks to the Aspire team, the AG's office, legal and regulatory affairs, compliance servicing, product ops, like everyone contributed to bring up the rules here today. So we'll go through kind of the history here. So in January of 2021, Governor Murphy signed the Economic Recovery Act, which had, I think, created and updated about 15 new economic development programs for the authority. In July of 2021, there was the first significant update to that legislation, and the EDA board approved the SPIRE rules November of that year. We received significant public comment on those rules throughout 2022, and the rules were heading towards their one-year expiration. And so the governor extended them for a year, and during that time, the authority and noticed that there were obviously changes in the economy, changes in interest rates, and so we started working with the legislature on additional legislation, which was signed by the governor this July. But throughout 2023, there were projects that were ready to move forward, and so we were approving projects under current rules throughout 2023. Next slide. So just quick overview, I think the board is obviously familiar with the Aspire program. It is a real estate gap financing program, a successor to the ERG program. It provides tax credits that are then monetized to help fill financing gaps in commercial, residential, and mixed-use projects. Next slide. So this is just a recap of the projects that the board has approved this year. Over $500 million in tax credits awarded, and over 1,600 residential units, a little over two-thirds of which are fully affordable. This is a mix of fully affordable rehabs, fully affordable new construction, mixed-income new construction, and Helix is the significant commercial project that we approved this year.
George, just out of curiosity, how many of these are there shovels on in the ground on?
Helix, obviously. Right?
Helix, obviously.
I think Northgate has started construction.
Yeah, the rehabs basically start straight away because there's much less limiting to starting right away. I think Manahan Village, which They're done, actually. Yeah, well, out of some peculiarity, but they had basically started their construction project before our approval. I think they're done.
But you're allowed to do after application.
Okay.
Next slide. So eligibility, obviously demonstrate the financing gap. The legislation, the new legislation, clarified the definition of reasonable and appropriate rate of return on investment. But we're just going to go through kind of the high-level changes in the legislation and the rules. Eligibility, the geographic eligibility remains the same, except for one addition of certain brownfield sites over 100 acres that expend more than $10 million in cleanup were added to the eligible area. And you can see the map there. Basically, the built-up areas of the state are the ones that remain eligible for state incentives, and the state's not using Aspire to build in more environmentally sensitive areas.
That brownfield thing is added by statute. That's not a choice.
Yeah, we don't have flexibility to just add geographic areas. Next slide. These requirements are mostly the same. They still need a letter of support from the governing body, and our standard affirmative action and environmental standards are required for every application. Next slide. So this is where the big changes start to come into play. These are the per project award caps. So now projects in Atlantic City, Trenton, and Patterson are eligible for up to, or they can be awarded 80% of their eligible costs, up to $120 million. Most projects the board will see will probably be at 60% of eligible costs, up to $90 million. Those are areas of qualified incentive tracts. That is, you know, high poverty, low income census tracts, municipalities with a municipal revitalization index score over 50, or an enhanced area, which those communities are listed there below, and and residential projects with a 4% low-income housing tax credit. Any other geographically eligible projects will get 50% of eligible costs, up to $60 million. These percentages are the same for the transformative section of the program, but the total award cap there goes up to $400 million. Next slide.
And transformative is based on the size of the project, correct?
The next slide. It's a great question. It is.
Keep going. It's not the next slide, but it's coming up. I'm looking at something delayed for some reason.
So one of the bigger things the legislation did was it gave the authority to adopt greater affordability controls for affordable housing units in our projects. So specifically, it requires, you see here on bold, that at a minimum we be consistent with affordability controls established in the rules and regulations adopted pursuant to the Fair Housing Act, generally referred to as UHAC, specifically around bedroom distributions. So this is requiring certain three-bedroom units in our affordable unit mix in order to better serve families in our communities, and a more prescriptive kind of spread of the low-income units. So, you know, at least 10% need to be for very low-income, making no more than 35% of area median income. In the bedroom distribution, at least 20% of all the affordable units need to be three bedrooms, again, to help better serve the low-income families in the state. Next slide. And the statute also made some changes to the net benefit test. We also made some changes to that just in the rules. So the previous legislation and previous rules had the net benefit test set at 185%, and by statute, the GRNs would be 35 percentage points lower, so that was 150%. The legislation included into that 35% percentage point lower bucket a few other categories, including research and tech-focused incubators of at least 50,000 square feet, properties that are awarded state or federal historic tax credits, certain major cultural institutions, certain federal land, and then we lowered the thresholds to 160%, and so that 35 percentage point lower bucket gets down to 125. Next slide. This is mostly the same, the community benefits agreements, which is one of the more premier, I guess, aspects of Aspire that we're pretty proud of. Still, all projects that have at least $10 million in project costs are required to have a CBA, except by statute now, if you're a fully affordable project in Trenton, Patterson, or Atlantic City, you're automatically exempt. And the municipality still has the option to pass a resolution to waive the community benefits agreement requirement if they outline in the resolution why they think the project is so important that they don't want to add those additional costs to the project. So it's still up to the town to decide whether or not they want the CBA, but they have kind of the ability to say the project's great, we want to kind of add those. That's the last slide. That's pretty much all of the major changes. We made some changes to the fee schedules to reflect the fact that we're going to be working with HMFA. The affordable housing units are going to be deed-restricted for 45 years. They'll have to report with HMFA for the next 45 years. There are various other changes. You have a 82-page rule document in your board book, and the beginning of that rules document has a more thorough summary of the changes between the old rules and the new rules. And that's it. Do you have any questions?
Yes, Coda's there before you.
Three things.
One, the governor signed this bill on July 6th or 7th, and it's November 17th or something, and so it's a hell of a sprint from there to here. So George, Kevin, Dan, Gabriel, Allison Jones, wherever she is, a number of other folks have worked incredibly hard to get from here to there. So two things. The affordability controls, just make sure everyone sort of clarifies. George said it perfectly. Without these changes, it's imaginable something we could all feel good about ourselves saying, well, 20% of these units are affordable. But a developer could just as easily turn around and say, well, those are all going to be studios. And that's technically compliant, which, again, would meet the previous letter of the law. Okay. But if you're thinking about building strong, vibrant downtowns and communities, some studios are great, I'm all for them. Folks just have to get started or don't need a lot of space, cool. But two or three bedroom units, making sure that there's support families, support intergenerational living arrangements, all those kinds of things is a really important thing. It is more expensive to build two or three bedroom units. It's less. Your returns are lower if you build bigger units because you get fewer tenants and your rent is lower. So that's one of the rationale for increasing the caps and increasing the percentage. So that's a bit of a kind of a push and pull there, but I think the policy outcome here is quite strong.
You're increasing the square footage ratio of the affordable units in the building as opposed to if they were all the same bedroom distribution throughout.
The second thing, net benefit agreement, you might notice, net benefit test, we're proposing to lower that from 185 to 160 for sort of the vanilla versions and then down to 135 for a big crop of projects. Simplest way to put this is we overshot it, but another way to put that would be I overshot it in setting the goal the first time. 185 was a bit high. We're seeing a lot of projects that are good and virtuous and have lots of good attributes to them. But this weren't getting home. And so lowering that a little bit while still leaving a really comfortable margin to make sure we're getting not only what we put into it, but a good chunk back. Makes good sense. The statute gives us the authority where to set that net benefit. It has to be a net benefit. We could, in theory, set it at 101. I wouldn't. And still be compliant with the statute. And so that's a bit of a reset and a recalibration. Combination of one, I think, again, take a mulligan on it. I overshot it the first time, and two, the market conditions are just tougher to get commercial products done, so having a little bit more give in the math is appropriate. Okay. Just a couple add-ons there. Thank you.
Did you say what transformative was?
Oh, I'm sorry. That's why. You're absolutely right. It's not up for some reason. So for transformative projects, we increased the project threshold cost minimum from $100 million to $150 million. Fully commercial projects still need to be 500,000 square feet. Those thresholds are lowered. For film studios, it's still 250,000 square feet. The GRMs, is it 200? 250 in the GRMs. If you're a fully residential project, it needs to be at least 700 units. It's down from 1,000. If you're a mixed-use project, a transformative, you need at least 50,000 square feet of commercial space, plus, I want to say, in the GRMs,
200 units?
Yeah. And then 300 units in an enhanced area and 400 everywhere else?
Yes.
So these are big projects, by definition.
Yeah.
Transformative.
And then again, the bigger they are, they'll scale with the percentage cost up to that cap of $400 million. So.
The restrictions again?
For the affordable units, we're in the Aspire rules, we're proposing to deed restrict the affordability requirement for 45 years. So it's lengthy, but we think it's important, and we're, you know, I think it's a generous program.
That also brings it into harmony with HMFA's approach.
Yeah, HMFA, I believe their qualified action plan is also proposed for 45 years. And we expect most projects that we get with affordable units to also have an HMFA participation.
Any other questions? Anyone on the phone have questions? Okay, hearing none. Could we proceed with a vote? Could I hear a motion to approve?
Motion, please.
Thank you. Second?
Second.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
That doesn't mean more for Essex County folks.
Any opposed? Any recusals or abstentions? Hearing none, the program passes.
I left out a thank you to Aaron's colleagues in the Governor's Counsel's Office, particularly the Rules Office, who were extraordinary partners in getting this to us, I think.
Yes, Brian Marco specifically.
Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you. The next item...
There's more coming behind us, so thank you. Continue, thanks.
I've asked State Treasurer Amoyo to lead the board, given my refusal.
All right, so the next item is Morgan Stanley Domestic Holdings Incorporated, as it pertains to the Grow New Jersey Assistance Program, and the modification, and it will be presented by Kaishan.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. We are requesting an approval to complete the certification of project completion and to affirm that the project has not materially changed, even though the eligible jobs were reduced from 251 down to 149. We're also requesting delegated authority to approve a further 10% reduction from the current number of 149 if necessary. As a result of this requested change, the approved award will decrease by 44% from $20 million down to $11.2 million with the potential for a further decrease. So the independent CPA certified that the company had made more than $15.9 million in capital investment, which exceeded the minimum requirement of just over $5.3 million. The company certified it created 149 of the 251 anticipated new full-time jobs, which exceeds the program minimum of 25. Morgan Stanley informed us that they were unable to meet their anticipated new jobs due to the impacts of the pandemic. Aside from the reduction of in the number of jobs, the company has stated that the project remains the same, as the jobs at the QBF are essentially the same as those included in the GROW application, and the median salary of those jobs has increased significantly. Again, the company expended over $15.7 million in eligible capital investments, created 149 new full-time jobs, and the project continues to satisfy the 110% net benefit to the state over 20 years. So based on that information, staff has determined that aside from the reduction in new jobs, project has not materially changed, and we are requesting approval to complete the certification of Morgan Stanley's project completion. Thank you. Take any questions.
Just a reminder for everybody, we do have from time to time. This is essentially a reset. If the application had come in June of 18, whatever this was, I was here for it. I remember this one. And they said we're going to create 149 jobs. It would have been calculated to be here 11 point something. That would have been eligible at the time. But we come back just to sort of post the board and get approval to sort of readjust those. And it's not their award ratchets down ratably and proportionally based on the less jobs. But 149 jobs would have been eligible. Would have better.
All right. Any other questions? Is there a motion to approve?
So moved, Angela.
Move.
Second.
Okay. All right. Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, recusals, or abstentions?
Can you state the reason for recusal on the record?
They're our financial firm for our pension.
Pay for it wise with that minus one?
Yes.
Yeah. Can you tell here? All the way recused.
Okay, thank you, State Treasurer. We'll continue. Tyshawn, you're going to do Maestro Technologies?
Yep. So similar to Morgan Stanley, we're requesting an approval to complete the certification of project completion for Maestro and to affirm that the project has not materially changed, even though the eligible jobs were reduced from 178 to 81. We're also requesting delegated authority to approve a further 10% reduction from the current number of 81 if necessary. As a result of this request to change, the approved award will decrease by 57% from 17.3 million down to 7.5 million with the potential for further decrease. The CPA certified that the company had made more than 1.6 million in capital investment, which exceeded the minimum requirement of just over a million. The company did not retain the 35 proposed jobs, but did create 111 new full-time jobs, of which 77 were eligible to be incented. And according to program rules, the new jobs must backfill the required retained jobs before counting as new jobs. Thus, the company certified to 35 retained full-time jobs and 46 new full-time jobs for a total of 81, which exceeds the program minimums of 27 retained and 19 new jobs, respectively. Maestro informed us that they were unable to meet their anticipated new jobs due to the struggle of hiring during the pandemic while simultaneously meeting the program eligibility requirements for full-time jobs. Nevertheless, they currently have 81 full-time jobs at the QBF and are in the process of hiring new employees to get closer to the total jobs anticipated at approval. So aside from the reduction in the number of jobs, Maestro has stated that the project remains the same as the company has relocated its headquarters to Trenton and the types of jobs are essentially the same as those included in the GROW application. So again, the company expended over $1.6 million in capital investments, retained 35 and created 46 new full-time jobs, and the project continues to satisfy the 110% net benefit to the state over 30 years. So based on the above information, staff has determined that aside from reduction in jobs, the project has not materially changed, and we're requesting approval to complete the certification of Maestro's project completion. Thank you.
Who wants to go inspect this one? It is essentially across the street here in the Starbucks. You can't miss it. Or basically more in space.
Any questions? Discussion? Okay, hearing none, let's proceed to a vote. Could I have a motion to approve? Thank you. A second?
Second.
Thank you. Hearing no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Any opposed? Any recusals or abstentions? Okay, hearing none, the motion passes.
Let's jump in with one personal privilege. Tyshawn, correct me if I'm wrong. We think that's the last GROMOD certification?
Yeah, everyone is certified. Thanks.
Hopefully, yes, that's it. It would be an appropriate time to mark and say deep appreciation to Bruce, Tyshawn, Akira, Lisa Patrizzi, a number of other folks who work incredibly hard on those certifications and make sure we get them right. Obviously, we spent a lot of time in 2019 and 2020 talking about getting it right with regard to tax credit compliance, and they do an extraordinary job having implemented a number of procedures that lead to the test outcomes of making sure we know what we're certifying and have all the right facts. I think, Bruce, correct me if I'm wrong, our running total now of certification sort of savings is approaching $500 million with these 25 of sort of what our enhanced due diligence has led to in terms of savings on tax credit certification. So quite a feat.
Out of how many total GROW awards?
300. How many have been certified? 275 or so?
Well, somewhere in the 200 range.
And now we're done.
No more certifications. We have to live with them and do the overall certification. So if you get your golden ticket at the end of the certification process, which says this is your 10-year tax credit, then you then redeem it in tenths. In most cases, there's some that go further. There's some that go shorter. That's the vanilla version.
So 2040
is when
we actually put
it. 2040 is when. Bless it.
I look forward to us all sitting here and approving it.
Next we're going to move to the program name of the day, the NJ Cool program. Sean's going to present.
Good morning, everyone. I'm here to present a memo requesting that the board approve the creation of the NJ Cool pilot program. This pilot is a grant program that provides financial support to property owners or tenants undertaking retrofit construction projects in existing commercial buildings. And those projects must result in a reduction of greenhouse gas emissions from building operations, primarily through replacing existing heating and cooling systems, as well as implementing other energy efficiency measures or on-site renewable generation. Building sector is the second largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the state. While the global warming impacts of burning fossil fuels are unfortunately very well known by this point, many refrigerants used in cooling and air conditioning programs are also considered climate superpollutants because these greenhouse gas emissions have hundreds to thousands of times the heat trapping power of carbon dioxide, and more importantly, are also the fastest growing source of greenhouse gases internationally and in the state of New Jersey. This pilot will utilize $15 million in NJEDA's share of state funding from the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, otherwise known as REGI, in accordance with the initiatives that were outlined in the latest REGI funding plan released this past July. The initial pilot will be limited to existing commercial buildings located in the communities of Newark, Edison, and Atlantic City. These three municipalities fall within the state's designated overburden communities, as defined by the state's environmental justice law, have a significant number of commercial properties and therefore eligible for the program, and are three of the top municipalities in the state by measured commercial building energy usage. The memo also requests that the board approve delegated authority to approve program grant applications up to a maximum award of $1 million per project. In addition, it requests the ability to expand the pilot program in the future by utilizing an additional $15 million in REGI funding should application demand exceed initial funding allocation. In order to be eligible for the program, retrofit projects must do one of two things, or potentially both. Replace fossil fuel combustion-based heating systems with non-combustion alternatives, or replace existing refrigerants with more environmentally friendly options. Additionally, we encourage whole building approach by allowing for emissions reducing or other energy efficiency measures to be undertaken with this minimum eligible requirement work. Applications for grant awards will be reviewed on a first-come, first-served basis, and approved applicants will be reimbursed for eligible hard construction costs in the form of labor, materials, and equipment at a rate of 50%. Minimum grant awards will start at $50,000 per project and will be capped at $1 million per project. All construction work supported via the program must be conducted in accordance with New Jersey prevailing wage and affirmative action requirements. After initial application approval and prior to executing a formal grant agreement with NJEDA and prior to beginning construction, the applicant must provide proof of funding for total estimated project costs plus an additional 15% of project costs to serve as contingency for any overruns or cost increases that may arise during the course of construction. Applicants will then submit reimbursement requests against their approved grant award on two occasions, once when they incur half of estimated eligible project costs and once again when construction is fully complete. Thank you for your time and consideration, and happy to answer any questions on the program.
Great job, Sean. A couple things. For anyone who might be listening out there in radio land or in the room, this is all voluntary adoption of technology. There's no mandates here. There's no requirements. No one's channeling my dear departed friend, the great Joe Fiorillo. No one's coming for your gas stove with this program. This is if you wish to adopt this technology, if you wish to make these energy efficiency investments, I would encourage you to. In fact, we are encouraging you with these programs, but these are not, there's no mandates, there's no laws, there's no rules, there's no stick, all carrot. The other thing is, great way to create construction jobs too. There's a huge energy transition ambition here around the building footprint. As Sean mentioned, it's the second biggest source of our emissions. It's not quite neck and neck, but it's pretty darn close to vehicles, which is the biggest one, or transportation, which is the biggest one. But there's a huge opportunity to create, you know, good, family-sustaining, prevailing wage-paying union jobs in supporting the energy transition here. So win everywhere you look. Excuse me. Win everywhere you look.
This is all REGI funded.
That's correct.
And do we have any idea if this is a pilot program, what a full program would look like, or
is there any contemplation of that at this point?
The map would certainly get broader. So this is three places to start and see how we do.
But with the funding, would we get more REGI funding to do this?
Yes.
The REGI funding comes in every quarter to the state, and EDA gets a set portion of that funding, and that's as long as power companies need to have auction credits, that money should be coming in.
The state has yielded approaching $500 million of auction proceeds.
Yeah.
Since government put us back in REGI. By the time we got back in, it was only 2019, but made the decision early 2018.
Do you know how many municipalities roughly in the state fit the eligibility guidelines?
The eligibility for Oberlin communities is set on a census block basis. These three, almost the entire municipality falls in that guideline. I don't know the number off the top of my head, but quite a bit.
I'm curious for the map broadening, if we open this up, how many?
Population-wise, it's close to about half the state, approximately in terms of residential size. So if you want to assume half municipalities, right?
Hey, Tim, it's Fred.
Hey, Fred.
Hey, any consideration, I just want to make sure I got it right. Is there any consideration to go to individual homeowners who are replacing their heating, air conditioning systems, similar like we did with the oil tanks?
Yes, this program wouldn't do that, and it's partially because our statute, the one asset class we can't touch is single-family residential. Looking at, where's Elizabeth? I'm sure DEP and BP were thinking about that challenge. I don't know if there's programmatic things that are available, but we are prohibited by statute from touching individual single-family homes.
Yeah, the DPU and the utilities are working on their own programs that will be geared towards the residential sector. That's how we're focusing on exclusively commercial.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Fred. Any other questions or comments? Okay, hearing none, could I have a motion to approve? Thank you, Jewel. Second? Thank you. Any further discussion?
Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Any recusals or abstentions? Okay, hearing none, we are New Jersey cool. The next two items are going to be presented by Olivia. And as Olivia walks to the podium, I just want to congratulate her on completing the Karen Franzini Fellowship.
Thank you. It was a really great experience. Karen's legacy lives, you know, in the EDA halls, but throughout almost all the organizations of the CDFA.
So. Great. Thank you.
All right. So the first thing I'm presenting is an update regarding the NJZIP pilot program, specifically in relation to our voucher recapture provision. We're requesting the members of the board approve allowing for a proportional repayment of the voucher awards based on the length of our three-year compliance period and a percentage of the vehicles in compliance. The NJZIP pilot is driven by pretty clear objectives of decreasing harmful emissions, expediting the adoption and utilization of zero-emission vehicles in the state, and enabling the EDA to gauge market readiness and the economic impact of such adoption. Following the disbursement of our Phase 1 vouchers, several awardees have had unanticipated changes to their businesses, resulting in some discontinued use of the NJZIP-funded vehicles. Though it might be disappointing to some, the NJZIP program will not be providing its consent to allow for NJZIP-funded vehicles to be sold or transferred to ensure that the program's effectiveness and it maintain our primary objectives. Mm-hmm. Allowing for our NJZIP-funded vehicles to be sold or transferred of the compliance requirements poses a lot of significant risks and can open doors for fraudulent activities, misuse of program funds, and can lead to a concentration of benefits among a select few. So allowing for transfers would introduce a lot of administrative complexities. This would involve verifying ownership structures, evaluating new applicants that have potentially differing criteria, amending award amounts, and documentation of new assignments, and vehicle agreements and transactions. And so, therefore, the program really cannot provide consent to allow for these NJZIP-funded vehicles to be sold or transferred. what happens if they do sell or transfer their vehicle, or really like in any other event of default during that three-year compliance period. Presently, the authority requires that the defaulting party repay all or a portion of the voucher award. And I think we can all recognize, right, that the consequences of such enforcement may vary depending on the business entity and their financial circumstance. So to address this, we're requesting that the members approve the pilot program update to implement that partial recapture mechanism, ensuring that the responsibilities are both maintained for their awarded vehicle, but also acknowledging and rewarding businesses for their years in compliance. So the proposed, you can see it on the screen, okay, the proposed recapture percentage are as follows, which would be within the first year of compliance, you would have to pay 100% of the voucher back if you default. 2 years would be 60%, and 3 years would be 30%. And I'll conclude with this, that NJZIP is really dedicated to promoting the adoption of zero-emission vehicles and reducing carbon emissions. The prohibition on vehicle sales and transfers is really crucial to streamlining our program operations and preserving the integrity of the zero-emission vehicle market, and we really want to ensure the program's long-term success. And so implementing this partial recapture provision is essential to holding our defaulting parties accountable while also providing some unique flexibility for circumstances. So I'll pause there and for any questions. Thank you.
So this is sort of akin to what we do on the GROW program, right, which is
yeah.
We look in and say, okay, we're going to deliver 100 jobs. It turns out you only delivered 80, so we're going to prorate your
debt. It's pretty simple. It's pretty well-known in our incentive programs, but as a pilot, we have a sort of an oversight that we want to adjust.
No questions. I want to say kudos for, you know, talking openly about administrative complexities, because very often people think, oh, you do this, and when you get down to it, not only is it complicated, but also it just takes so much time away, and really, it hurts the mission of the program in total, so I appreciate bringing up this work.
Are they able to sell the vehicle after they repay the voucher? Is that what this is the intent?
So if they did want to sell the vehicle, they would be in default with the program, right? So if they sold it, they would need to repay some percentage of the voucher back to us. Sold it within that three-year term.
Anyone on the phone, questions? All right, hearing none, could I hear a motion to approve?
Thank you. Second.
Thank you. We have a second over here. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? Any recusals or abstentions? Hearing none, the motion passes.
No. All right, so the second thing we're presenting today is the second phase of the Commuter and Transit Bus Private Carrier Relief and Jobs Program. This will be a $12 million program to provide grant funding to eligible commuter and transit bus private carriers in New Jersey. A private carrier is a private bus company that contracts with NJ Transit to provide services throughout New Jersey. These carriers are experiencing reduced ridership due to our continued remote and hybrid work schedules in our post-pandemic economy. The program would be set up as a non-competitive grant, so that application would remain open for a set period of time. We're saying no less than 2 weeks, and all applicants that apply within that period and meet the eligibility requirements will receive a grant. The $12 million second phase is funded by the state's fiscal year 2024 budget, so the authority will take up to a 5% admin fee or admin percentage, and then that would leave our eligible program funds to $11.4 million. Phase one of the program supported 13 transportation companies who operated through the public health shutdown and faced additional financial strain due to our increased sanitation protocols and reductions in customers. Approvals were conducted via delegated authority to the CEO, and we are looking to leverage the same delegation for this phase. In phase two, we are proposing a more standard award formula that will adequately address the entire struggling industry and stricter language on our applicant certifications and compliance. And based on publicly available data we have, we expect there to be about 10 eligible applicants. Now, eligible applicants would receive a flat grant amount of $1 million, capped at their unmet need, which we're defining as 2022 New Jersey revenue loss, which would be the delta between their 2019 New Jersey revenue and their 2022 New Jersey revenue. And this is also less than any other public or private relief funding that they may have received for 2022. The memo does allow us to adjust funding levels if the applicant pool is either larger or smaller than we anticipated. We'll continue the EDA standard eligibility via for-profit business, New Jersey registered entity. We'll do our good standing checks. And then the program-specific eligibility includes providing a specific fixed route or commuter bus service, having reported more than 0 miles federally, so we know that they were, in fact, driving. And then we also confirm with NJ Transit. And then at the time of application, applicants will need to certify their peak vehicle requirements they need from NJ Transit. This is calculated yearly by our sister agency. Then we want to make sure those haven't materially reduced since 2021, and then they'll need to confirm and certify that they will not change throughout our grant compliance period. So in summary, this would be a $12 million second phase private carrier program providing grants to our eligible commuter and transit bus private carriers in New Jersey who are experiencing our reduced ridership because of our continued remote and hybrid work schedule. Thank you. I'll take any questions.
This was an appropriation made to us in the 2024 budget, correct?
The most recent. The most recent.
Yes. Any comments, questions?
And by the way, one might ask, why is this us, not transit, who supports the community bus network? Broadly speaking, there's some quirk of how federal funding works and what they're allowed to fund, who they can, how they can do it. I don't fully understand it, but I've been told by smart people that there is a reason, there's a channel conflict. That's us pitching it here.
Okay, hearing no further questions, could I have a motion to approve?
Motion approved.
Thank you. Second. Thank you, Robert. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Any opposed? Any recusals or abstentions? Hearing none, the motion passes.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to switch to Venture. Emmanuel on the New Jersey Innovation Fellows Fall Cohort Application Approvals.
Good morning, board members. Thank you for the opportunity. This month, staff is recommending the approval of 10 teams of entrepreneurs in the inaugural cohort of the New Jersey Innovation Fellows Program. The recommended approvals represent those top 10 complete eligible and scored applications with an aggregate award amount of about $3.6 million. Additionally, there are two recommended declinations. The list of recommended approved applicants are attached in your appendix, Appendix A of the memo, and those recommended for discretionary declinations are in Appendix B. The award in the form of income replacement grants will enable would-be entrepreneurs to launch innovative businesses in the state of New Jersey. As a point of reference, the authority's board approved the New Jersey Innovation Fellows Program in November 2022, following its establishment through legislature-made findings and declarations relative to the state's entrepreneurs that directed the EDA to invest in diverse talent critical to New Jersey having a vibrant ecosystem. Per program policy and in accordance with the legislation, approved teams qualify to receive $200,000 as a base award and up to $200,000 in opportunity zone residency, diversity, and education bonuses. The application period, which opened on March 14th and closed on June 19th, saw a total of 43 applications submitted, requesting the total benefit amount of over $17 million. Just some data on those numbers. 30% of the received applications were proposing to launch innovative businesses in the professional services sector. 19% received applications are proposed innovative businesses in the information and high technology sector. And 22 of the applicants were declined under delegated authority. Declined applicants have 10 days following board decision to file an appeal. Applicants approved by the board will have 30 days to form and register their businesses. if they have not already done so. All applicants will have 60 days from the due date of approval notification to execute their grant agreement. Following execution, fellows will begin to receive quarterly grant disbursements of the award over the next 2 years, so long as they are in compliance and they meet milestones, and they'll commence the required mentorship program administered by either NJIT or Roman University. Thank you so much for your attention here, and we appreciate your consideration and approval for this historic and impactful set of recommendations. We're optimistic that this program will provide a pipeline of new, diverse businesses into New Jersey's innovation ecosystem. I can answer any outstanding questions at this time.
This is really exciting. A couple of things just to kind of foreground or background this. This is another piece with our broader efforts around inclusive innovation, and specifically has its central presumption that a lot of entrepreneurs and first-time entrepreneurs, fund themselves with friends and family. Not everybody has friends and family. It's bottom a $250,000 to pursue their dreams, and that's disproportionately true for Black, Latino, women, immigrant founders, veteran founders, et cetera. So this is an extremely important sign and signal of our commitment to inclusive innovation. Also worth noting, there's 10 companies on this page. These are all, they're so early stage they barely exist. So this is a high beta. There is a decent chance. Hopefully 10 out of 10 of them become the next Tesla, and that'd be amazing without all the problems that come with Tesla. But, you know, the next great big company that does really well, decent chance most of them won't. And so this is you know, very much a early stage, high beta, but appropriate, I think, pretty hard lean into inclusive innovation. The other thing I noticed, that map, I mean, if you ran a simulation of this program, you know, a year or two ago, you probably would have thought it'd be mostly sort of Jersey City, maybe Newark. Mm-hmm. You've got really good geographic distribution. You've got Vineland, you've got Gloucester, you've got Burlington County as well. So, you know, a really good, geographic distribution here. In fact, probably more so southern focused than you probably would have guessed, mm-hmm. Which is great. That's a good thing.
Would the next cohort be a year from now?
What's the application period will start early next year, so it's Q1 next year.
We start to the back year probably. So.
So, I mean, are we expecting to do sort of one round of this per year kind of?
Well, the initial intention was about two per year, but given that this program is very different from what we've ran before, we've, you know, had to adjust many things internally to make it happen. But the goal also get it going and meet certain cadences to have two cohorts per year.
We have $10 million available under this program, so if you ran it at 3.6 times 3, you get three cohorts, but we'll see how things play out in the future.
And then you also said, I think we have two declinations?
Well, discretion and declination.
Okay. And we're going to vote, and assume they can appeal?
Yes.
Okay. Can we start funding the winners? Meaning, do we have contingency for the appellate? If the appeals people win, does that box somebody out? Or we have, it's like, NOL, we're going to close them all at once. We can get going. Great. Thank you. Could have covered that. Sorry. Thank you, Kevin.
Any other comments, questions? Anyone on the phone? Okay, hearing none, could I hear a motion to approve?
And vote.
Rod, second?
Second.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Okay, exciting, hearing none, and motion passes. Next, Curtis Lee on the New Jersey Innovation Evergreen Fund, some new qualified venture firm approvals.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm pleased to be with you this morning to present our recommendations for this month's proposed qualified venture firms, also known as QVFs, to join the New Jersey Innovation Evergreen Fund program. We continue to expand our engagement with venture capital firms in search of co-investment capital from the Evergreen Fund. For context, we are tracking more than 100 conversations with venture capital firms across the country since the applications first opened in December of last year. Thus far, the EDA has received 17 applications and has approved 10 QVFs. Today, the Venture Program Department is presenting an additional 2 QVFs for approval this month. QVF designations are made on a rolling basis, and applications are reviewed at the, in the order in which they are received. The application period for venture firms will remain open throughout the life of the program. Following staff review, the recommendations offered here today have met all program eligibility requirements and minimum scoring requirements as determined by the Venture Programs Department in conjunction with the Product Operations Department and the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Department. The scoring rubric and the results for each application are detailed in the recommendation memos in your package. The two QVF applicants for certification today are Activate Management, LLC, a Pennsylvania-based early-stage venture capital firm investing in digital healthcare and business technology companies, scoring 26 out of 37 possible points. Of note, the EDA is an investor in Activate Fund 2 Annex and the predecessor fund, Milestone Ventures Fund Number 4. And second, Cornucopian Management Capital Management, LLC, a New Jersey-based early-stage venture capital firm that primarily invests in innovative food and health technology companies, scoring 22.5 out of 30 possible points. Staff plans to present additional QVFs for approval throughout the life of the program as we continue to build a pipeline of engaged VC partners to invest in high-growth, innovative, New Jersey-based businesses. And I'll just conclude my remarks by reiterating staff's recommendation for approval of the two applicants as qualified venture firms, which shall be approved under separate votes for each applicant. Thank you for your time and consideration, and we welcome any questions at this time.
Curtis, as your slide says, we've got 10 that we've approved to date.
That's correct.
And we made our first investment at the last meeting.
Correct.
That's
right. Exactly. One huddle.
Any questions, comments? Anyone on the phone, questions or comments? All right, none being heard. Can I hear a motion?
Thank you. Second. Thank you. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Hearing none, the motion passes. Thank you. Next, Lori, on adoption of written post-issuance compliance procedures.
This is an administrative request to approve the written post-issuance compliance procedures for the $79.6 million tax-exempt 2015 Series A NJEDA Liberty State Park bond. To enumerate the responsibilities as it relates to a state-backed bond issue, the request also asks to approve the use of professionals and authorize authority staff to take all necessary actions incidental to the request. This request is made in coordination with and direction with the New Jersey State Treasurer and the Attorney General's Office and reviewed by Bond Counsel Jerry Alstow. As required pursuant to IRS requirements and in accordance with the tax certificate, the authority has been undertaking arbitrage compliance with respect to the bonds. The authority now desires to memorialize those ongoing tax compliance procedures in writing pursuant to and as described in the written procedures. The authority, in consultation with bond counsel, will supplement and update these procedures as appropriate to provide a continuing source of guidance on these requirements. This is the last state-backed bond issue requiring board approval of its written post-issuance compliance procedures. I welcome any questions you may have.
Last post-issuance compliance, last grocer. This is like the Oscars with the montage.
Or
like,
I know.
Slow music, sad music, last time we get to do these things.
Well, going forward, they'll be included with the bond transcript.
The bond that matures in 2037, so you never know.
2027.
any questions? Okay, hearing none, can I hear a motion to approve?
Motion approved.
Thank you. Second?
Second, Marcia.
Marcia. Any further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Recusals or abstentions? Hearing none, the motion passes.
Thank you.
Next, Thomas Murphy, our CIO, on additional funding for MIS.
Yeah, thank you. We were here back in May to start a project with Microsoft. Back to Adesh to request additional funding in the amount of $390,000 in order to leverage a technology that's available to us. We already own it. It's part of our agreement with Microsoft. This is for the development and customization of this B2C portal. I use this particular slide to demonstrate because I think everyone's pretty familiar with being able to use cross-platform Gmail, Facebook, and other things to sign up and share privileges across, across these platforms. Obviously, it has the protection of PII that we're looking for, multi-factor, all of the other things. It's just leveraging the greatest technology available at this time for this project. So I'm back to say, I think we need to include this. We definitely need to include this, not bank, in order to deliver this product. So this pretty, in order to deliver the IDMS in January.
And this is B2C, so is this how the public interacts with us? Or?
It would be how the public interacts with us, and it also uses our Active Directory authentication. It takes into account we're also in the GCC, which is the government cloud. We're not in the commercial cloud, so there is additional FOIA protections there.
And this is particularly important, too, for our tax credit applicants who are doing the compliance work. Current portal we have, to use the technical term, stinks. And it's very unpopular. This would be a new, much better platform for our customers to use.
Good. Any questions? Okay, hearing none, could I hear a motion to approve? Thank you. Second?
Second. Great.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Recusals or abstentions? Hearing none.
Steph Curry walking away with the ball still in the air.
High confidence from Tom.
All right. Tim, board memoranda?
Yeah, I'll be brief because I want to make sure we have time for an executive session without pushing people past lunch. The 5 memos in your pack, again, harmonious with the idea that we talked about the board dashboard. A lot happens between these meetings. One I'd highlight, which I also mentioned briefly during the CEO report, the Angel Tax Credit Program continues to be a frequent flyer, labor-intensive, really good program, really important to our early-stage economy, and very, very high-volume product for us. And that's incorporating the memo there, but yield back to you, Mr. Chair.
Great. All right, now I'd like to open the public comment portion of the meeting. First, I'd like to ask Danielle Esser to read the NJEDA's public comment policy and process for this board meeting.
Thanks, Chairman. As stated in NJEDA's public comment policy, members of the public who wish to speak during the public comment portion of the meeting will be acknowledged to speak first in person, then by phone during the public comment. Members attending meeting by phone who are interested in providing comment can press 1, then 0 on their keypad to be registered to speak, which will place each person into a queue based on the order received. Guidelines for public comment. Each speaker will be prompted to speak one at a time. Each speaker should announce his or her name, organization, affiliation, and topic on which their remarks will be given. Each speaker has a maximum of 3 minutes to speak. It should limit their comments to matters pertaining to the authority. Staff will prompt the speaker once their time has expired, and the speaker may only provide comment once during public comment to ensure there is enough time for all those who wish to speak. Lastly, any members of the public who wish to provide comment can submit comments in writing, by email, or hand them over when they're in the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Danielle. I will now acknowledge members who wish to provide public comment at this time. Anyone in the room? All right, no in-person. Anyone on the phone?
Ladies and gentlemen, for members of the public on the phone, if you wish to ask a question, please press 1, then 0 on your telephone keypad. You may withdraw your question at any time by repeating the 1-0 command. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up the handset before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you have a question, you may press 1, then 0 at this time. We do have a question from Carol Katz. Please state your affiliation, and you may proceed with your question.
Hello. Good morning. My name is Carol Katz. I'm with Katz Government Affairs, and I represent the Bus Association of New Jersey. And I'd like to thank you all for adopting the much-needed Pandemic Relief Fund. I did have some questions because it does sound like some of the provisions of Phase 2 are different from Phase 1, and I have some concerns about those, which I could share with you. I guess my request is how much discretion will the staff have to address some of these concerns if it turns out that they sort of impede the workability of the program. I think I heard that all eligible carriers have to be under contract to provide commuter service with New Jersey Transit. I think in Phase 1 they had to provide commuter and regular route service, but not all carriers are operating under contract with New Jersey Transit, and a number, I think probably all our members, provide some at their own risk. And it's actually those routes that we operate at our own risk that are under the most financial hardship. So I want to make sure that we're not somehow excluding a carrier that is operating at its own risk. I also heard that there's a cap of $1 million per carrier up to the demonstrated need. I'm concerned that that could be considerably lower than the need for some carriers, and maybe I don't know who the 10 seems like a high number to me, so I don't know who some of those are, but maybe their demonstrated need is not up to the $1 million, and I wondered if those other funds would be redistributed as necessary or as warranted, that surplus. I also heard something about the peak vehicle requirement not being reduced during the period of the grant. While the grant money is really needed and very, very useful, I'm not sure that it will be able to sustain operations across the board, you know, as much as we try very hard to. I don't know. I have to confer with my members, but I'm concerned with that the requirement of not reducing the peak vehicle requirement at all could be a stumbling block. So, and I am not the subject matter expert, although I did my best to understand. So I know when I go back to my members, we may have some concerns, and I'm hopeful that you will grant discretion to the staff to address some of those as we raise them.
Hey, Carol, it's Tim. Good to hear your voice. I hope you're well.
Thank you very much. You too.
I suggest we should probably have a follow-up conversation, you know, as soon as practicable with you and your members to make sure we go through all the, you know, any questions and make sure you understand the program as fully as we can. The one sort of two macro considerations here that are important to me/us. One, there's only $12 million and there's a lot of need out there, so we gotta label it out somehow fairly and rateably. It's a much bigger need than $12 million. We get that, but there is $12 million in the program, so we're going to make some decisions accordingly to our rationing. Two, if folks have, you know, cut service off relatively recently, you know, I think it's appropriate that we prioritize those that have not. So, maybe that's an opinion, but I think it's one that's valid. And so we're happy to walk through the particulars of the program, you know, with you and your members, you know, once we wrap up today. But I'll ask Olivia and Kathleen and the team that are working on this to follow up. And Carol, you know where to find me, so we can.
I do. Thank you very much. We will look forward to that, and I appreciate that.
I'm sure I'll have an email before you even hang up the call. I got it.
Okay. Thank you.
And if there are any additional questions, please press 10 at this time. And we have no other questions. You may continue.
All right. Thank you, operator. Given there are no additional comments, I'd like to thank everyone for their participation today. I would like to now request a motion to enter executive session to receive attorney-client advice and discuss a real estate matter where disclosure could adversely impact the public interest, the minutes of which will become available when the need for confidentiality no longer exists. The vote will take place after the board returns to public session. So could I hear a motion to approve moving to executive session?
Yes, you have a friendly amendment. Your notes, you read them perfectly, but there actually will not be a vote. There's not a vote.
Nothing to vote. Motion, Cruz. Thank you. Second?
Robert. Second.
Thank you. No further discussion. Could I hear a motion to approve? Signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right, thank you. We're going to move to executive session.
The board will now enter executive session. For members of the public, you may hold on the line. Board members and staff will return to this line when executive session has concluded. One moment, please.
So, executive committee and John.
One moment, please. And the lines have been rejoined.
Okay. If there are no additional comments, I'd like to thank everyone for their participation. And
sorry,
I will,
we actually opened the door, just so I feel better being it open.
And we'll now request a motion to adjourn the meeting. Can I hear a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second.
Second. Thank you. All in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Aye. All right, none heard. Thank you. This concludes our meeting. Thank you, everyone, and have a happy Thanksgiving.
Let us conclude our conference for today. Thank you for your participation and for using AT&T conferencing service. You may now disconnect.
For all of those board members in the room, if you haven't signed your SSPCI disclosure, everyone in the room has? Okay, so
okay,
people on the screen. Yeah, thanks.
It's good. You're asking the right question.
They were a 25% owner of Oshawa. They broke up. They had a bad marriage.